Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Respiratory Life series, featured exclusively on the ERS Respiratory channel. We're available in video and podcast format. And what we try to do at Respiratory Life is to explore a wide range of topics, giving some insight into the working lives of respiratory clinicians and their interactions with the world around them. And joining me for the fourth episode, once again, is Imran Suleiman.
Hi, Brian.
And Laura Gleason.
Hi, Brian.
Not joining us, as eagle-eyed fans of the series may notice, is Breida Cushion, our friend and colleague who joined us for the first three episodes. Breida has found much more useful things to do since we last recorded, and I think we'd all like to congratulate Breida on the arrival of baby Annie. Hopefully she'll be back for future episodes. I wanted to talk about something today that may be slightly controversial for some of the people listening to us, and that's really about how the role of the physician in respiratory medicine and generally speaking, and the role of the clinician are evolving. So I want to touch on how we're evolving, how we practice medicine, and also changing who the people practicing medicine are. But first of all, what I thought would be really important to do, because I think, you know, a lot of our people listening to this will probably be working in the UK, and we've seen a lot of unrest there over the last few months between the doctors, particularly and nursing staff who staff the NHS and the government there, such that there's been waves of strikes, particularly from trainee doctors, but laterally, and actually as we record this, there's a consultant strike. It's a big thing for healthcare workers to go out and strike, isn't it? Have you ever done it?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes, I did. Back in 2013, I think it was, we had a NCHD strike in Ireland and I was part of it.
Did you have any moral qualms about that? Did it strike you at any point that as a clinician, as a healthcare worker, that it might not be in your patient's interest for you to do that?
At the time, it was something that everyone was very aware of, both from kind of a ethical or moral responsibility point of view of not wanting to leave the hospital kind of in the lurch, but also from an optics point of view, because obviously when you're engaging in strike action, one of the really important things is having public support. And as you say, it's kind of a controversial thing for healthcare workers to go on strike because there is this sort of altruism built into the profession. So it was something that I think everybody at the time was really conscious of. But I think it was really important.
Well, what tipped the balance for you? I mean, at the time, I wasn't working in this country, in Ireland at the time, so I wasn't involved at all. But what tipped the balance to make people go, right, we need to do something here? And what were your, in your own head, what were the goals of that action?
Basically, I mean, I graduated in 2010 and worked as an intern and as an SHO. And I feel like it was kind of one of the lowest points in hospital medicine in Ireland at the time. Morale was really low. We were like still working kind of like 32-hour shifts once a week regularly. And I think what tipped the balance actually, because what happened in that instance was it was a really grassroots movement and there was some NCHD suicides. And one of them was actually a friend of mine who I was in college with. And her death really kind of, I think, kind of drove everybody forward. And it was really people that knew her well that kind of like started that whole movement. The whole concept of the strike initially was really about just reducing the working hours so they were something humane. And that was kind of the entire point of it. And actually what we were kind of looking for at the time was just 24-hour shifts being the cap. So you'd never work more than 24 hours in a row. But around that same time, the European Working Time Directive had come in and Ireland obviously needed to start aligning towards it as well. So in the end, I mean, I think there are still places around Ireland where people are working extremely long shifts, but certainly in Dublin hospitals.
But particularly the thing that was motivating people at that point was, it wasn't so much financial, it was more related to quality of life.
It was
experience.
In no way was it financial, definitely not. Like the whole purpose of it was just trying to achieve just working hours that were humane. That's how I would describe it. And I fully believe that if we hadn't gone on strike, then they may have brought in the European Working Time Directive at some point, but it definitely would have been much slower.
So that's probably a little bit of a contrast, I suppose, to certainly the consultant strike in the UK. I think the trainee doctor strike in the UK probably is coming with a substantial number of other motivations. But for both, particularly the consultant one, but the trainee one as well, a large part of the reason that these doctors feel the need to go out and strike is because of the very, very substantial levels of pay erosion that they've seen for those grades over the last 15, 10 years particularly, such that people are now, you know, somebody who's a newly qualified doctor in the UK probably earns about 20, 25% or even more of a reduction compared to what their contemporary would have earned, somebody at their grade would have earned in real terms had they graduated 15 years earlier. Do you think, I mean, Imran, like, would it, if you were in a position where you had seen significant pay erosion, like our colleagues there have done, would you feel that it was a reasonable thing to take industrial action, to walk out of your clinic and refuse to see patients for a number of days?
I mean, it's a difficult question, it's nuanced, but I mean, the short answer is yes. As public servants in a public job, why shouldn't we have the opportunity to strike for better working conditions, including better financial improvements in our salaries? I mean, for example, two of my colleagues who are working in London as consultants, you know, at the peak of their professional career, can't afford to buy a home and can barely afford rent in where they live, which is kind of crazy to think that you're at the height of your professional career and you can't afford that. So yeah, I mean, I think with safeties in place, which is how all these strikes happen, that there is, and it's not a strike that in a way that will impair patient care, that there are safeties in place that patients still get
definition
care.
Though it is going to impair patient care, isn't it? Otherwise, what's the point? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're
sure, I mean, from an emergency point of view, sure, and acute medical care is what I mean, that won't get impaired.
I think as well, part of the reason for striking is to kind of ensure good patient care, yeah, into the future. And without getting overly political about it, I think it has to do with a sense of the value of healthcare in the UK kind of being eroded, and this idea that it is not something that the current government or society want to invest money in. And it makes actually a very important point when people strike to say, well, actually, we are a vital service that is actually, you know, at the heart of what is required at any kind of functional society. And I think that's, it's kind of future-proofing the profession into the future to say, look, this is actually like the bedrock of what our society is built on, and money has to be invested into it. You can't ignore it, you know, you can't toss it aside and prioritize other things that are not about kind of basic human rights and that are more about just making profits, etc.
There's a whole lot to be thought about the longer term benefits for a successful outcome here in terms of what patient care looks like in the future. Because if all of the super highly qualified and very, very capable people who are on strike this week in the UK because they cannot afford what are reasonable things to be able to afford, then they're going to leave. They're going to come and work over here. They're going to come and work in Canada. They're going to go and work in Australia. And then you will not have a functioning health service.
But even the ones who aren't going to leave. So if they say, oh no, you know, I'm here and I'm going to like commit myself and, you know, I'm not in it for the money. I'm in it for the goodness of humanity and this is it. They are also trying to ensure that the profession will be protected into the future. So if you're going to make 10 times more money working in the city for an investment bank, and if you're not even valued for the contribution you're making as a medical professional anymore, then why are people going to go and do the arduous training and work the long hours in order to provide that care that we need? Yeah. And it's not even just about the money. I think it's about the way society is valuing the medical professionals in the UK at the moment. I think it's more about that than money alone, you know?
And all the cool kids coming up through school and coming through college will see this and they will go, well, stuff that.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm, I'm going to go and change track here, and I'm heading off to do law. I'm heading off to do banking, because why would I put myself through that?
And ironically, the UK at the moment are trying to develop NHS workforce plan to kind of...
Oh, we're going to come back to that.
To protect the future, to kind of combat this recruitment crisis that they have at the minute. But actually, just treating the current staff as valuable members of the workforce would actually help to recruit
people. It strikes
me
as, I mean, from a bit of a remove, it strikes me as a real cost-value supposition again, where the cost has been seen, but not the potential value. I'm very glad that I've never been in a situation where I've had to go out and strike, and, you know, my heart goes out to all of those who are involved in it. It's really tough.
Yeah.
Really tough.
It kind of does feed into what I want to talk about, though, which is about how we develop clinicians has changed and how that's likely to change into the future, and how the care that those clinicians deliver has changed and how that's likely to change into the future. Increasingly, I feel like such an old fogey. I remember as a medical student and as a junior doctor, having these almost godhead consultant clinicians who were firm practitioners of the art of medicine. Famously, one clinician who worked with us and when I was in medical school, who had this great story about how he had been able to diagnose multiple sclerosis in a young lady because as he was getting into a lift with her, he saw the way that the light glinted upon her eye. And, you know, whereas I would need an MRI and was lumbar puncture and whatever, and a smart neurologist, he was able to do that. And he was an endocrinologist, by the way. And, you know, so we would follow these usually older men around, many of us looking sad in white coats.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would watch solemnly as they percussed out the heart borders and then, you know, spent quite a lot of time auscultating the precordium in all sorts of slightly funny and completely obsolete ways. And some point along the way, that all kind of just sort of vanished. And I don't think those guys really exist anymore. And, you know, for people like me who are kind of very analog in a digital age, it can be sometimes be quite uncomfortable. So the way we do things is very, very different from how it used to be. Imran, you're a big advocate for point of care ultrasound, which I think is a manifestation of how we've used emerging technologies and just smarter ways of doing things to facilitate better care. Can I ask you, do you think the stethoscope is obsolete?
My short answer is yes. I use point-of-care ultrasound for everything. I use it in clinic. I use it on consults. I use it on ward rounds. I use it in the emergency department. I think it's an invaluable...
Do you own a stethoscope?
Currently, I do not. I have a loaner of a stethoscope hanging in my office.
Well, what do you use that for? Is that just kind of doctor cosplay?
Yeah. Good question. A little bit. Yeah. It just hangs on the side of my lab coat. I still wear a lab coat, by the way.
Yeah.
But mostly everything I do is history, good history, and good point of care ultrasound.
I have a stethoscope, yeah, but I don't have a point of care ultrasound.
Really? I thought you were another POCUS fundamentalist.
I mean, I do enjoy ultrasound, but it's just a big machine to bring around with you unless you have the small. It's so interesting you wear the white coat, though. So you're kind of fulfilling that, like, master clinician.
Yeah. I mean, like, so seriously, the combination of the white coat and the stethoscope, is that just to persuade everyone that you know, that you're an esteemed doctor should be listening to it?
The white coat, I guess, is something I lingered on from practicing in the States where we all wore white coats. And then it's also useful for putting my point of care ultrasound in and carrying it around. So, yeah, pockets are the key thing.
So I mean, that was a slightly frivolous question, but it speaks to a broader point, which is how do you feel the learning curve in figuring out how to interpret the information you get from POCUS is compared to what we had to go through to figure out what we were doing with a stethoscope? You know, like, I don't know if you guys ever got to the point where you were absolutely confident that when you plonked a stethoscope in someone's heart, that you were adequately interpreting what you could hear, or when you're listening to their lungs, that you had a full handle on exactly what was going on down there. But to get to something even approaching that, you would spend years and years and years watching people do it, then emulating them and trying to figure out what it was yourself. There was a subjectivity to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a subjectivity to it. Some people were very good at it and some people are less good at it, even with equivalent exposures. How does something like POCUS compare?
I mean, it's similar. You need a lot of experience doing it regularly, but there's a visual component to it, right? So it's physically seeing an image in front of you. And I think the beauty with point of care ultrasound is that you're the physician or clinician doing the diagnostic imaging procedure on the patient that you're caring for. So you have the information of the patient in front of you. You have the imaging in front of you to inform your decision about treatment straight away at the bedside. And I think that's a new art of medicine, maybe, you know, and it fosters this art of medicine that we're talking about in a different way with different technology.
But additionally, doesn't POCUS give you verifiable, recordable information that you can then play back and show people?
Absolutely. I mean, this is another thing that we do from a training point of view that you wouldn't be able to do with stethoscope. So as a trainee in ultrasound who's doing loads of images can record all of your images. And I do this with some of my trainees that get them to upload all their images online, and then I can review all their images and talk about their interpretation of it. So it's real time. And in fact, with some of the ultrasound machines, you can video call into the person doing it, watch them doing it, and watch them real time do the images and tell them, oh, you need to move your probe a little bit this way or change the gain or the depth on the image to get a better
image. Huge implications for teaching, right?
Yeah.
And also has potential implications for the speeding up of teaching.
Yeah.
Obviously, when somebody is listening with a stethoscope, you can't hear what they are hearing, whereas you can see what the person is seeing. So I guess it does make it, from a training perspective, easier way to train somebody.
Yeah.
How much more quickly do you think you can teach someone to recognize a pneumonia or heart failure on ultrasound of lungs rather than using a stethoscope? Because, I mean, I think it is something that would come to old-fashioned clinical skills, like that is a learning process of months and years. Can you take somebody with ultrasound and take them to that level of capability faster? That sounds like a weird question, but I'll try and make more sense of it in a second.
I'm not sure the right answer to that. I guess it depends on the learner and the teacher, right? If you are a visual learner, which I think I am, which I found through point of care ultrasound, I was able to learn and use it a lot quicker than I felt that I did with a stethoscope.
Yeah, I also think probably a bigger contributor is the availability. You know, so everybody from a second year medical student onwards has a stethoscope, basically, but having a point of care ultrasound is not always, you know, something that people have. If you're teaching someone and they have a stethoscope and can listen to 20 sets of lungs a day, versus you have ultrasound available to you once a week or something, it's going to be a slower process that way.
In our ICU, on rounds, we ultrasounded every single patient every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then on consults, we ultrasounded everybody every day.
The reason I ask about speed here is, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the UK already, but we're going to come back to that for a second at least. There's increasing focus, I think, across particularly the Anglophone worlds. I'm not sure how it works across the rest of Europe because I'm not so au fait with their media. But if you look at the Anglophone world, there is generally a shortage of doctors in most places and clinicians. And part of the drive to try and remedy that has been very much focused not so much at keeping people happy and satisfied and as productive workers, as we've already discussed, has been more focused on potentially getting more people in. So we know that in the UK, the NHS workforce plan would suggest that they're going to double the number of medical school places in the next 10 years or so. They're also talking about having apprentice doctors, whatever they are, so we'll go in and not do the kind of conventional clinical training that we all did, but we'll instead shadow other clinicians on the ward and eventually apparently achieve equivalent rates of competency. But a lot of this is about speeding up training. And a lot of talk is given to dropping time from training schemes and from medical school time. Does a move away from a need for art and subjectively based interpretation of not immediately verifiable data, do you think that lends itself to sort of sped up training?
Yeah, I actually think it does. One of the things that has been lost, I think, already is the time that we actually give to practicing medicine. And now a lot of our training and a lot of our actual job is really focused on efficiency. And it's really focused on, you know, getting through things quickly. And you were talking about taking detailed history. You know, sometimes the history is sort of neglected in exchange for looking at results. And actually building up that kind of master practitioner level, it requires time, you know. I'm not going to spend time percussing at the heart because why would I do that, right? Because I've got X-ray, I've got a CT scan, I'll send them for an echo. That kind of skill of, you know, being able to percuss a heart, it requires that you kind of spend time doing things that are not necessary or efficient over many years, and then you build up this skill set. So someday, when you glance at someone,
some magic day that part.
When you glance at someone in the lip, you suddenly realize
that. But is that stuff worthwhile, though? I mean, I'm not clear from what you said there whether that stuff is worthwhile or whether I'm pining nostalgically for the field.
Yeah, it depends on what you think is important or not. Obviously, there's a huge number of people in the world. We want most people to have efficient access to reasonably good healthcare. So in that case, prioritizing efficiency is important, but it is losing something. It'll be very difficult to get it back again in the future, you know? And I think part of it has to do with the kind of values that are being instilled in trainees now, but also just in medical professionals now. This idea that actually being efficient, being quick, getting through things is the number one. That kind of idea of being a master clinician is sort of not really valued as much anymore.
You mentioned the perceived importance of getting access to, what was the phrase you used? Adequate assessment by a clinician.
Yeah.
And I think there's two things I'd like to explore from that. Increasingly, we see that a lot of physician-y jobs or physician-y roles are now taken up by non-doctor healthcare practitioners who may operate at a very high level, but are not physicians who have gone through the traditional doctor-y style training. Have you seen examples of that, Imran, that have worked well? And have you seen examples that have maybe been, to your mind, slightly problematic?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of good experience with the use of ANPs and physician associates in the States. Like, some of our ICUs were staffed purely by PAs without any residents. So it would be PAs, a fellow, and an attending, and it worked perfectly because they were trained at a high level to function within an ICU and to do everything that's required for the care of a patient in an ICU, like lines.
Are there limitations to those roles?
Yeah.
How do you control for kind of mission creep where people start taking on jobs that are really necessarily qualified?
There are some limitations to that role. And I think, like, you know, as the name, like, for example, a physician associate is associated with a physician. So there needs to be a clinician involved in the program. You know, same with our ICUs or the chest service, there would be a physician associated with it. And it's, I guess, going back to what Laura was saying, this art of medicine or this lateral thinking around medicine comes with time and experience, not necessarily the ability to percuss the heart borders, but I think it's a skill that we all learn through years of experience of taking in all this information.
So we're all quite old, except for Laura.
Yeah.
We're in a comfortable enough position that we are in tenured posts.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of younger trainee colleagues who maybe might take a more, I was going to say strident, but would maybe have a less kind of nuanced view relating to non-physicians taking on or non-doctors taking on traditional doctor roles. So I think there's a lot of unease about their potential future roles being usurped by people that come from different tracks.
I think that is particular for here and maybe the UK because it's relatively new.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas in the States, it's been there for a while.
And you think, having seen it in a more kind of matured manifestation, that you don't think that it has significant negative impacts about physicians' ability to do their job as well or to have jobs to do?
No, it worked perfectly. Specifically to the example that I was saying earlier, we had in two hospitals, we had two ICU teams per hospital. One was staffed by residents and fellows, and one was staffed by PAs and ANPs, and it worked perfectly.
Dora, I was wondering if you might address the second part of that, which is whether you think that we have a overwhelming push towards kind of algorithm-based care or guideline-based care, and if you think that something like that is problematic.
I think probably we do. I would say, like, there has been a rise of the protocol definitely over the last, you know, probably two decades-ish, one decade at least.
And sounds like a cool band name.
It does, yeah.
Or album name.
Yeah. Rise. It's quite metal, isn't it?
But I don't know, like, I don't know, is it bad or good? Because I think medicine has become more complicated, right? So there is more stuff to remember. So then having things protocolized, especially, you know, if you're involved in general medicine practice, it's very difficult to keep up to date with every single thing that might cross your path. So it's good to have kind of protocols in place. But I think on the other side of things, it can lead to kind of lazy practices and also kind of defensive practices, because it's difficult when the protocol exists to deviate from the protocol, even if your professional opinion is that you should be managing things slightly differently. It requires justification if you're deviating from a protocol, if the protocol exists, especially in situations where potentially you don't have senior clinician presence kind of overseeing the use of the protocol, that it can lead to kind of lazy practices where somebody is just following the protocol and not using that lateralized thinking, as you say, and taking into account that the situation may be more nuanced than the protocol allows for.
And I think there's a really entertaining, potentially, tension between people who, between guideline or algorithm-based medicine and my favorite thing in the whole world, which is personalized medicine, which when misapplied is often used by random quacks on LinkedIn who are flogging things.
What is your definition of personalized medicine?
I think we can have many, many definitions, some of which provide incredibly effective care to people who need it. Like, you know, look how cancer therapies have changed in the last 15 years versus non-evidence-based kind of, oh, well, you know, it's only your little toe that will tell us about what kind of therapy you are going to need.
Well, so what I think you're talking about is actually protocolized, personalized medicine, you know, where, like, so for the cancer immunotherapy, you know, if you have this mutation, then this is where you fit into this line of the protocol.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a very wide-ranging discussion. I thought it'd be interesting to see how long the concept of the obsolescence of doctors had been out there in the medical literature. So for my primary care friends and colleagues, I have a great piece for you from Dr. Jay Watson in the Journal of the Australian Family Physician, which is, quote, "Be prepared for the obsolescence of the GP. Good news is that if you started working as a GP when this chap published this, you are probably now retired and may not actually be able to use technology to listen to this podcast, because that was in 1978. But going back before that, and maybe related to hospital physicians, is, unfortunately, I couldn't actually read this, but it's from Dr. Bell Irving, published in the Journal of Northwest Medicine, called simply "Obsolescence of Physicians." So that was published in 1969, and even I wasn't born then. So, you know, hopefully that's a sign that we're not going to be completely obsolete in the next few years, and we might at least make it to retirement age without some firiness because we're pointless.
And AI won't take over?
Well, we've talked about that before. You told me they wouldn't. You said there'd be no rise of the machines. Okay, well, right, before we get back into the AI, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Imran.
Thank you, Brian.
And thank you again for listening. If there are further episodes for Respiratory Life after this, then you'll be able to find it right here on the ERS Respiratory channel. Thank you very much.